Good morning, and you are listening to WUML Lowell. The name of the program is Thinking Out Loud. We have on the line with us right now Norman Solomon. Norman, welcome to Thinking Out Loud.
Hi, thanks very much.
And we're very excited to have you on. I've been reading about your what you've been doing here. You've written, your most recent book is War Made Easy. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the subtitle kind of sums it up, how presidents and pundits keep spinning us to death. And of course, I talk about what's going on now with the Iraq war, but I don't buy into the idea that somehow this is an anomaly and has never happened before. We've heard that from a lot of folks, including many Democrats, who say, gee, this is the first time that we've had that sort of deception dragging the United States into war. And I go back the last 50 years and find time after time, from the Vietnam War and the invasion of the Dominican Republic in 1965 to today, deception hasn't been unusual. It's been routine.
I know. And you make mention here that the United States has combat-ready spin.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who produces this?
There are very severe consequences. Well, it's produced by mainstream media in concert with the White House. Every time a president has wanted to go to war, he has been able to drag the country into war with the help of those who've been called the punditocracy, the commentators, those who should be watchdogs, but they're often lapdogs. They're serving the official sources that they rely on. This is true not only of the essayists and the columnists and the pundits on TV, but also those writing front-page news, as we found with the New York Times and other media outlets, simply laying down the, you might say, laying down the flagstones on a path towards war, and we suffer, and people in other countries particularly suffer the consequences.
You know, media has traditionally been the guardian of the truth. What has happened to media?
Well, I think that a lot of that is our nostalgia for a golden age that never existed. Certainly, the proper role of media outlets should be to serve as guardians of the truth, to be tough, assertive, independent, not stenographic towards those in power, but critical and skeptical. And yet what we've seen over the decades, and going way back as far as we can in American history, we found, yes, some courageous journalists, but the dominant news media have generally served those in power who wanted to bring the United States into war and keep it in war. And so if you walk back through the last 50 years, as I did in the book, Vietnam, Dominican Republic, aiding in Central America wars by either Contra guerrillas in Nicaragua or repressive regimes in El Salvador and Guatemala, you look at the invasions of Grenada and Panama in the 1980s, the Gulf War, the bombing of Yugoslavia, the bombing of Afghanistan, the Iraq invasion, quite a few other military actions that are smaller but not insignificant. And you get the reality that the U.S. news media have been handmaidens to the war makers, not critics.
Yeah, both Dave and I, this is Dan, both Dave and I are Vietnam veterans, so we are pretty familiar with making up a scenario to start a war. Can you elaborate a little bit on what happened there?
Yeah, well, of course, the consequences are horrific for those sent to fight the war, those who live in the country where the war has been inflicted. In the case of the Vietnam War, contrary to myth, we did not have a vigorous press preventing the United States from engaging in the war or escalating the war or keeping it going. We had a press that, if you look at the microfilm of the front pages of the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, helped propagate the falsehoods of the Gulf of Tonkin incidents that led to, 3 days later, really, the only instance or closest instance to the United States coming near a declaration of war from Congress. The reporting on the supposed unprovoked attacks in the Gulf of Tonkin were basically instances of reporting of falsehoods as absolute truths. And then you had year after year of basically winking at the deceptions that were part of the stock and trade of President Johnson and then President Nixon to try to justify escalation of the war. And, you know, there's a mythology that somehow the U.S. media were very critical of the war, and yet you look at what was being said by anti-war activists and those inside the military who came to oppose it, and the mainstream U.S. media were very much behind the curve. They were always behind, as a whole, Those who were critical of the war, who were making very clear analytical statements based on history. As a matter of fact, in early 1968, the Boston Globe did a study of a few dozen major U.S. newspapers and their editorial policies. The Globe did not find a single U.S. newspaper calling for a swift withdrawal of U.S. troops from Vietnam.
There's been some recent revelations about the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, and we work here at a university, and I talked to some of the students here, and they don't even have any idea what the Gulf of Tonkin was. Could you elaborate a little bit on what that was about?
Yeah, well, the Gulf of Tonkin is located off the coast of Vietnam, and in early August of 1964, there was a report that a pair of U.S. ships had been attacked unprovoked by the North Vietnamese Navy, and then a follow-up report 2 days later that a second attack had taken place. Again, the U.S. public was told by the White House and media that those attacks were unprovoked. And so the Johnson administration, which wanted to escalate the war in Vietnam, immediately went to Congress with what became known as the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which basically said that the Congress would support whatever means the United States government, the president, deemed necessary to respond to North Vietnam and the situation in Southeast Asia. And that was passed with only two dissenting votes, two members of the U.S. Senate, Wayne Morse of Oregon and Ernest Greening of Alaska. And that really boosted the escalation, which then began in earnest the following spring in 65. And, you know, you had 100,000 troops sent, then you had a total of more than half a million U.S. Soldiers in Vietnam. It sprang from a basic deception where most of what was reported to have taken place in the Gulf of Tonkin never did. And what may have taken place with the first attack was not unprovoked at all. The United States itself had been shelling the North Vietnamese coast.
That's correct. That was the destroyer Maddox, and they claimed that a patrol boat went out and dropped a torpedo aimed in Maddox's direction.
Right, the Maddox and the Turner Joy. And the net effect was to, in many people's eyes, legitimize a war that, of course, had horrific results, 57,000 U.S. troops dying in Vietnam, and an estimated 2 million Vietnamese people killed as a result of the U.S. war.
You know, it kind of leaves you wondering, and we pretty much all of us seem to think we know the reason we're in Iraq, and it's for oil. What do you think it was that was motivating President Johnson to go into Vietnam?
Well, I think these wars are multifactorial, and certainly oil is a key part of the Iraq war, not the only reason, but I think a key one. Nobody I know thinks that there would be 150,000 U.S. troops in Iraq if there wasn't a drop of oil under the sand in that country. In terms of Vietnam, there was a very big push from the Pentagon, and this is one difference with Vietnam. There are a lot of similarities in terms of the two wars, but a difference is that during the Vietnam War, a major push for escalation came from the Joint Chiefs of Staff and top military officials in the Pentagon. It's been quite the opposite. It's been the neocon fanatics in Washington, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Bush, who have pushed and pulled the United States into war. And it's been the Joint Chiefs and many top generals who have been very reticent, very hesitant, were not enthusiastic about this war. The reasons for the Vietnam War, I think, were, of course, inclusive of the Cold War.
They wanted to flex the technology, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, I think that there were whole new ranges of technologies that were used mm-hmm. by the U.S. military, and there was what Dwight Eisenhower, as president, called the military-industrial complex. Then, as now, a lot of profits that were being made by these military contractors as the troops went out and the military equipment and weaponry and bombs were sent into not only Vietnam but elsewhere in Indochina, Laos and Cambodia, horrific bombing campaigns run by the U.S. military day after day and year after year. So there was a lot of profit made. There were a lot of killings made by Wall Street, by major military contractors, and there was an ideological commitment by many people in Washington. They saw, or at least portrayed, the Vietnam War as part of the battle against the communist menace.
By the way, we're talking to Norman Solomon. He's a syndicated columnist on media and politics, and he's written loads of books. The most recent one is called War Made Easy: How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. But your previous book was Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. So I wondered if you could talk about those two books and about Iraq.
Yeah, well, I wrote co-wrote with the foreign correspondent Reese Ehrlich the book Target Iraq, which was published 2 full months before the invasion of Iraq began. And unfortunately, the book was prophetic. It talked about the lies and deceptions that were part of the supposed case for war made by the news media in the White House. It talked about how, contrary to claims, there was not evidence, any evidence whatsoever. As a matter of fact, I said point blank in the book that there was no way that there could have been nuclear weapons under development in any significant way in Iraq prior to the invasion. And, you know, this is the reality that a lot of lies in agenda setting for war, just as was true for the Vietnam War, was also true for the invasion of Iraq.
But I keep hearing, you know, when I watch the talking heads on Sunday, and both sides voted for this, and the reason we voted for it was because of all the intelligence that we were hearing from Germany, from France, from the United States, were telling us that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. And they sound so convincing. We had guys like Kerry and Senator Clinton saying, well, in fact, you know, there might be a threat. Was it obvious?
Well, Kerry and Clinton are two of the shameful senators who backed this war. No, it wasn't obvious at all. And this is not just hindsight. I'm at the Institute for Public Accuracy, and anybody can go to our website archives, www.accuracy.org, and we released dozens of news releases in 2002, before the invasion began, and early 2003. We haven't changed a word. They're posted on the site, and we raised fundamental questions challenging the notion that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. It's not because we're very smart. It's just because we were skeptical and didn't take the word of the pundits and the White House officials who were spinning madly for war.
I have to ask you this question. You seem to provide all this other information, but you obviously have sources which enable you to then challenge some of the information that you've posted. Where do you get your information, might we ask?
Well, I go to a lot of places, to even official hearings where buried in the blather is some important information. Also, a lot of it is contrast and compare. You can even go through U.S. news media, New York Times, Washington Post, and see the contradictions, even though the punditocracy, the editorial writers are often oblivious to some things that appear often at the end of articles in their own newspapers. It's also going to other sources. In case of nuclear weapons or other charges of WMDs in Iraq, Mohammed al-Baradei, Hans Blix, Scott Ritter, these were all people that I drew upon before the war and in looking at the evidence and writing the book. You know, if people look at my new book, War Made Easy, they'll find many hundreds of footnotes, which doesn't prove that what's in the book is true, but it does help people to look at the information and then find out where I got it and make their own decisions.
I want to switch a little bit. Speaking to Norman Solomon, he's an author and a columnist and involved in politics and how media portrays the politics. I wanted to talk about alternative media because, you know, that's what we are. We're a college radio station with obviously not mainstream media, and obviously we have a point of view that differs from especially mainstream radio.
Yeah.
Do you have any ideas, or would you like to talk a little bit about alternative media?
Well, I think that independent media that are non-corporate, that are willing to question the conventional wisdom and the power of the national government, that's very important. And if you simply rely on, for instance, NPR on the radio, you're going to get a very narrow range of sources and perspectives. So I think independent radio stations, to the extent that they can function with autonomy, with a wide range of views, with a lot of different sources, whether they're affiliated with a college, whether they're affiliated with nonprofit foundations, they can provide, to some extent, a very strong counterweight to what dominates the airwaves. And the same goes for independent print outlets, The Nation, The Progressive, In These Times, The National Catholic Reporter, Z Magazine, local and regional weekly newspapers, for instance. Then there are websites, and, you know, we could name literally hundreds that are doing good work. Some of the most prominent, Truthout, Common Dreams, Alternet, Counterpunch, Buzzflash. These are important efforts on the web that are raising key issues and providing key information.
Norman, I'm sure you're concerned, as we are, about the consolidation and centralization of the ownership of the mainstream media. And can you talk a little bit about that and what the implications of that are in terms of wars?
Well, absolutely. Ben Bagdikian, who started his journalistic career in Massachusetts at a daily paper, went on to the Washington Post. He then became dean of the journalism school of the University of California at Berkeley. He wrote a book in 1983, published by Beacon Press, called The Media Monopoly. And since then, the book has come out in six different editions. And Mr. Bagdikian documented that every time there were fewer and fewer large corporations, larger in size, fewer in number, dominating through ownership the media flow of information in this country. In 1983, the first edition said there were 50 corporations that through ownership controlled most of the news and information flow. In the last couple of years, his latest edition says that that number's down to half a dozen. And that trend has very ominous implications. It means fewer gatekeepers, larger companies basically dominating the media environment. All the more reason that we challenge mainstream media and develop independent sources.
Norman, you are the head of the Institute for Public Accuracy. Okay, that's the National Consortium of Policy Researchers and Analysts. Where are you physically located, and how do you get your funding?
We have two offices, one in San Francisco, which is our administrative office, and one in Washington, D.C., in the National Press Building, where we do our media outreach. We're funded by private donations. We don't get any corporate money. We certainly don't get any government money either. Individuals and foundations give us donations in support of our work, and we proceed to try to provide to the news media and the general public commentary, analysis, information, sources on breaking news that are not generally available in the mass media.
You're interested in contemporary politics and war, but you seem to link that always in many of your books with media. Why have you made that connection, and why is that something that you're really interested in?
Well, if we're going to have a democratic system, then the body politic needs a free circulation of ideas and information. And the media are supposed to do that. You know, the First Amendment is a place where the only location in the U.S. Constitution, there's a specific mention of an industry or profession, and that is the press. And that circulation of information and ideas in the body politic, if it is blocked, if there's blockage, then you have a serious problem. That's what we have ongoing in the United States, I believe, when there's so much information and so many perspectives that get short shrift in the mass media. And that's the way we find out things. That's the connective tissue, to switch metaphors a little bit, that makes it possible for a democratic body to move, to function, to be functional. And so if we don't have news media that are independent, that are free-flowing, then the possibilities for authentic democracy become very limited.
I find that I like to read the most interesting part of any newspaper to me are letters to the editor. And I think for what exactly what you're saying, I had a very interesting experience yesterday. I went out and I bought two newspapers. I bought the local Lawrence paper, the Eagle Tribune, and I bought also the Lowell Sun. And the Eagle Tribune has twice as much editorial space, letters to the editor, and people, you know, writing in with different opinions about different things than the Lowell Sun had. I think that's important. As you say, that's where the juice is. The juice is in the democracy. It's in the people. A lot of people have access to other, you know, bits of information that are very helpful to all of us in gaining an entire perspective. But as you indicated, and Dan did too, you know, when there are a few sources, we after a while, it's like brainwashing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the centralization, of course, has terrible results. One is the war in Iraq. I mean, basically, you had the very small circle of major media outlets that were able to dominate the tone and tenor of coverage, and they bought the media line. They were the government line, and we can see the consequences.
How can we get a more democratic media? Is it possible? Is it going to happen? Do you see any hope?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball. I do think there's some hope because people are more mobilized. There's the more of a development of independent media. There's more healthy skepticism, not cynicism, but healthy skepticism towards mainstream media. So there is some hope, but there's also a tremendous battle going on. A very far-right corporatist regime is in power in Washington. They have control of the White House. They have a majority in Congress, and they're not going to give up without a fight. I'm not a Democrat. I'm an independent. This is not a partisan thing to me. It's about democracy. It's about people in high positions who lie, who use their economic and political and media clout to manipulate, to drag the country into war while at home. Healthcare, nutrition, education, these are vital services that are being defunded and slashed while the military budget is now way up into $500 billion a year. So, yeah, I think there's a basis for hope. But like always, you know, and historically, as we know, from in terms of labor history, Lowell's a place where, as many others at various times, it's been about people organizing and struggling. That's how change happens.
We're talking to Norman Solomon. He's a syndicated columnist on media and politics. Maybe you want to talk about some of the books that you've written, and are you writing another one as we speak?
Well, I'm hoping to write a book in the next year that's about where this country is now and where it's going. The book you mentioned, War Made Easy, came out this summer, and it's getting a good response. I should say that if people would like to read excerpts from the book, you can go to our website, which is warmadeeasy.com. It's just on the web at warmadeeasy.com, and you can get a bunch of information about the book and some of the background of why I make the assertions that I do, some of the evidence and information. Also, I'd recommend that people go to accuracy.org on the web and look at the news releases that continue to come out from the Institute for Public Accuracy. And, you know, you mentioned two of my books, the most recent being War Made Easy and Target Iraq. But I also have written some books that are collections of my columns. The most recent, a few years back, is called The Habits of Highly Deceptive Media. And I've tried to look at the ways in which various media outlets are, unfortunately, quite manipulative, rely on official sources to a great extent without doing the independent journalism that really is essential for democratic decision-making.
Well, Norman, thank you very much. We've certainly enjoyed having you on the show today. You're listening to Thinking Out Loud from WUML Lowell 91.5 in the FM dial.
WUML Lowell.
WUML Lowell.